Miss Carol, and we will then see you following the service this morning. For the rest of us, if you would take your Bibles and turn with me to the 10th chapter of the Gospel of Mark. Mark in chapter 10. It's the last message in Mark before we take a Christmas break. We will enter the Advent season. Next week, Pastor Jamie McDonald, who was here in the spring, will be beginning a series in Advent, which is entitled Anticipation. He gave me the idea, and we've been talking back and forth in terms of how to do this. So I don't know if I announced it last time. When he came last time, Jamie was actually my preaching prof when I was going to seminary. He's not that much older than I am, but that's so you can blame him for any inadequacies, all right? So, but he's a fine communicator, so he'll be here next Sunday morning. We happened to reconnect over these last year. I kind of came to mind, and I said, I wonder if he's still, and sure enough, so be good to have him again. Every Monday morning, or most Monday mornings, I have breakfast with a friend of mine, and we've been doing this for 40 years. So yeah, he's a good friend. And when we have breakfast, one of the things that, if you observe, is, and I pick him up, and we go to the A&W on 200 Street in Langley. If you ever are there on a Monday morning, there's a good chance you will see us there. Pick him up, and as we get out of the car, I have to come to his assistance, and increasingly so, because Len has retinitis pigmentosa. What? Yeah, it is a degenerative eye disease which he was born with, for which there is no known cure, and he is almost has no sight left, just a very little bit. And so I help him into the restaurant. He's got his white cane, which helps a little bit, and escort him to the booth, and have become familiar, as I know him, with the world of the blind. And all the complications that arise because one can't see. The one thing about blind people, though, is that they usually can hear pretty good. That's their active sense. And so I've entered the world over these years, increasingly so, of those who cannot see. One has to give caution. Oh, there's a ledge there, or it's little things that you become aware of, like little wet signs in the restaurant where it says, you know, just mop the floor, and it's got, you know, you can't see those, and or chairs and all kinds of things. So it's always a caution in terms of, yeah, watch out for that, or this is in front of you, or watch out for the car. Those kinds of things, or there's instruction or assistance. And that was kind of interesting. About a few weeks ago, Dari actually came along with me. Dari recuperating from a broken ankle, and I've had something with my knee, and especially then I was kind of hobbling around, and here were the three of us going to A&W. So what a motley threesome we looked like, you know, as we kind of hobbled our way in. Well, this morning we want to enter the world of a blind man. It's the last miracle in the Gospel of Mark. I don't know if you ever thought about what it would be like to be blind. I'm always amazed by those who can read Braille. Like that's pretty cool. Huh? Just slide their fingers along and read. As quickly, maybe even more quickly than sometimes we can read books, but that's the world we want to enter into this morning. The next stop, which we will carry on after Christmas as we The time between Christmas and Easter is the final week of Jesus' life in the Gospel of Mark. So it's worked out just nicely. And after Christmas, we will go on the road to Jerusalem and the triumphal entry, and then that last week of the life of Jesus before his crucifixion and resurrection. And so this is the last stop now before the entry into Jerusalem and the triumphal entry and the healing of this blind man. So I suppose one could say that this final healing, as we read about it here, metaphorically summarizes the gospel. It's a very good snapshot, if you will, a real-life illustration of what the gospel is. Blind beggars healed by Jesus. I don't know if you ever thought of yourself as a blind beggar, but that's a great descriptor for the world. Groping. But we'll get there. It's the reason Jesus came. And so we're just one paragraph this morning, one story, Mark 10, reading from verse 46 down to the end of the chapter. And they, being Jesus and his disciples and the entourage before, as they were on the other side of the Jordan, it says, they came to Jericho. And as he was leaving Jericho with his disciples and a great crowd, Bartimaeus, a blind beggar, the son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside. And when he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to cry out and say, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. And many rebuked him, telling him to be silent. But he cried out all the more, son of David, have mercy on me. And Jesus stopped and said, call him. And they called the blind man, saying to him, take heart, get up, he is calling you. And throwing off his cloak, he sprang up and came to Jesus. And Jesus said to him, what do you want me to do for you? And the blind man said to him, Rabbi, or Rabboni, let me recover my sight. And Jesus said to him, go your way. Your faith has made you well. And immediately he recovered his sight and followed him on the way. The way then, in 11:1, next stop, Jerusalem. Six parts to this morning's text, if you are keeping score with me, in this final miracle of Mark as we encounter a blind man. First of all, in verse 46, his dismal plight. The chapter concludes, this final story opens with the descriptor that they came to Jericho. They're on the way from the other side of the Jordan. Jesus had gone from the Galilee down through into Judea, but to the other side of the Jordan River, had done some ministry there, and now is coming toward Jerusalem, and from the other side of the Jordan to Jerusalem, and he passes through the little town of Jericho. I guess they rebuilt it since the walls came down, 1,500 years previous. But they come through Jericho, one of the oldest cities in the world. It still stands. Let's just retrace a little bit here to help you understand where he's going. Chapter 9, verse 30, they went on from there and passed through Galilee, and he did not know anyone there, so they're passing through Galilee. Then chapter 10 and verse 1, he left many, went to the region of Judea and beyond the Jordan, and crowds gathered to him. They keep to follow him, and so he's the other side of the Jordan, and now verse 32. 2, and they were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them, and they were amazed, and those who followed were afraid, and they, taking the 12, he began to tell them what's going to happen to them. I'm going to Jerusalem, I'm going to be delivered to the chief priests and the scribes, and they're going to condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles, and they're going to mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him, and after 3 days he's going to rise, speaking of himself, as they are now going to Jerusalem, okay, Jericho. Jericho is 40 kilometers east of Jerusalem, slightly north. And when it says he's going up to Jerusalem, for if you go there, you understand what that's about. For you are indeed going up. Although you're going west, you are going up in terms of elevation. Jericho, about 40 kilometers east of Jerusalem, is 840 feet below sea level. Okay, so it's down there. Jerusalem is 2,500 feet above sea level. So you add we're over 3,000 feet climb in elevation. If you go there, one of the things that I always find interesting is as you're climbing, you come to a sign beside the road as you're coming up from from Jericho, and it says a little sign, sea level. That's kind of interesting, and there ain't no water anywhere. It's desert. And so they're ascending this hill. Up is, in the Bible, not typically north. Up is up. So they're going up to Jerusalem. They stop in Jericho before the ascent. And I have a picture in my mind of Jericho as you visit it today. It's one of the stops, even in terms of the political climate in Israel today. A lot of that has significant history and pieces that connect to it. But when we were coming into Jericho on our tour, there's a big sign there as you enter Jericho that says, Jews not welcome, enter at your own risk. So I said to our tour guide, I said, what, are you safe in here? He says, yeah. He goes, I bring them business. So anyways, we stop at this, I guess, what is it, a tourist stop with souvenirs and drinks and ice cream, and they welcome our tour guide and into Jericho. Still there. It's one of the stops. Oh, the one thing I remember, almost forgot, is outside that shops is, was it one or two camels? I remember the camels, and you can go get your picture taken on a camel in Jericho. So that's my tourist promo for this morning. Jericho. We're told here that a large crowd is following as he's leaving. I think, if I'm not mistaken, one of the other accounts talks about him entering Jericho. And you say, oh man, look what, they're wrong. And one guy says he's leaving Jericho, one says he's just entering Jericho. It seems to be, according to the archaeologists and historians, that there was actually an old Jericho and a new Jericho. And probably he's between the two, leaving the old and entering the new. But however we want to put that, there's a large crowd who is accompanying Jesus as he leaves Jericho. Now, the crowd can either be seen as a group of followers, his entourage is not limited to only 12 disciples following him, a large crowd, or these are pilgrims going up to Jerusalem for the feast of Passover. That is very possible. It's one of the three annual feasts that every Jewish male by law was commanded to attend every year. And so these were the big feasts, and they were going up to Jerusalem. And if you go to the book of Psalms, you'll see after 120, something like that, in the book of Psalms, you'll see a heading that says Psalms of Ascent, A-S-C-E-N-T. these are the psalms that they sang as they went up to Jerusalem, as they ascended to the holy city. And so that may very well be who these crowds are. And as we come to the triumphal entry, that's in part what all these crowds are doing here, welcoming their Messiah into Jerusalem. All right, so that helps explain at least partly the number of people that are going there. It's feast time. It's pilgrimage. So it's clearly a crowded roadway on the road now out of Nazareth, next stop, triumphal entry, Jerusalem. On the way out of town, they encounter a man sitting beside the road begging. Now, we don't see too much of that here in the West, but I have, in some of my travels in some of the more third world kinds of countries in the world, seen this. Beggars, blind, it tells us he's blind, beggars. It's when you first see it, it kind of takes you by surprise. It's kind of a shocking display, well, kind of revolting that anybody could live like this. I suppose when I was young, when we went to Tijuana into Mexico, and you see the old lady with her children or whatever, she looked older than probably she was, and just sitting there begging with her, one with a baby, probably more particularly even when we went into both to adopt our children in Russia and in Ukraine, and you're walking the streets, and these babushkas are sitting on the sidewalk trying to sell sunflower seeds. You know, it's just, you can't get much lower than that in terms of trying to make a living. Or people in the subway of New York City who are handicapped in one way or another and begging. This is the situation, and it would have been fairly common in that world. We do know that in the book of Acts, as Peter and John come to the temple post-resurrection, post-Pentecost, and they find a man begging there at the temple, and they said, well, we don't have any money to give you, but what we do have, we give to you, rise up and walk. And so this is not uncommon, but here's a man. So he's one of thousands that Jesus encounters now as he's leaving Jerusalem. It even names him. We're, as I'm studying this, told that this is the only time that a person who is healed by Jesus is named. You can do what you want with that. I find it interesting that he's named now in the very last miracle in Mark. He's named because he's not just a beggar. He's Bartimaeus. Now, I don't know if he was famous in the area, or his dad was, but if his dad would have been famous, he would have had some means, so he probably wouldn't be begging. But you can try to figure that all out, why he's named. But he is. Perhaps he's widely known, but we might almost for sure know that this is routine for him. This is where he spends his day. Beside the road, leaving town, perhaps he parks himself under some kind of a tree. And day after day, month after month, and year after year, he sits there and he begs. Can't see, probably somebody helps him there, and people threw a few coins because for the Jews, almsgiving was part of what they were required to do. That was part of their legal obligation, and so that's how he would make his living. Alms for the poor, alms for the poor, he would yell all day long. A dismal plight. Really? Sometimes I like to put myself into the clothes, into the shoes of a man like that. What would it be like? I mean, this is hopeless. This is how you live your life. Can't see nothing, right? There's no transistor radio to listen to music. Really, it's a picture of all of humanity if you want to look at it that way. Sitting beside the road, blind and begging, looking for the answers to life. Looking for life. Looking for some meaning, some purpose. But they can't see. It's dismal plight. Secondly, verse 47, his earnest plea. His earnest plea. News comes to him that Jesus, now notice how Jesus is referred to in the first reference here. How is he identified? Jesus of Nazareth. What's Nazareth? Nazareth is the place that Jesus was raised. That's his home. It's where he grew up as a boy, as he becomes a teenager, and then a young man. Nazareth. Nazareth is Jesus the man. Human identity. Ronald of Langley. Well, actually, you would probably say Bar John of Langley. That's me. That's where I'm from. That's where I was raised. It identifies me. It's his address. Okay. Oh, just back here, Bartimaeus, his father is Timaeus. And you can just get that by his name. The word bar, the term bar in the Hebrew, it means son or son of. B-A-R. When Jewish boys hit 13, they have their bar mitzvah. Bar mitzvah means son of the commandment. They're now of legal age. They're all of the age of accountability. So bar mitzvah, son of the commandment. Bar Timaeus, son of Timaeus. That's his dad. So they know who he is. So it says, when he heard of Jesus of Nazareth, he began to cry out and say, Jesus of Nazareth, have mercy on me. Is that what it says? No. I find that interesting. Mark tells us that it's Jesus of Nazareth, that's his physical identity, but that's not how he identifies Jesus. That's the first sign of the faith of this man. He knows something about Jesus that we need to understand. He's not just a man. Who is Jesus? In his eyes, the Son of David. Now, what's the deal about that? Glad you asked. Isaiah chapter 11. Isaiah 11. 1. There shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse. Who's Jesse? Father of David. Okay. There will come forth a shoot from the stump of the father of David, Jesse. A branch from his roots shall bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, and on it goes. So we have this reference to this one coming who will be the son or the heir or coming from the shoot of Jesse, whose son was David. So a first allusion to someone who's in the line of Jesse that will be great. Jeremiah chapter 23. Jeremiah chapter 23, verses 5 and 6. Jeremiah 23:5. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will raise up for David a righteous branch. And we've talked about the branch already in Isaiah. This is a shoot that comes out from the tribe, the family of David. Where are we here? And I raise up David a righteous branch, and he shall reign as king and deal wisely and shall execute justice and righteousness in the land. In his days Judah will be saved and Israel will dwell securely, and this is the name by which he will be called: the Lord is our righteousness. This branch, this son of David, this king who is coming. Ezekiel chapter 34, as we run through the major prophets. Ezekiel chapter 34, verses 23 and 24. And I will set up over them one shepherd, my servant, who? David. And he shall feed them. He shall feed them and be their shepherd. And I, the Lord, will be their God. My servant David shall be prince among them. I am the Lord. I have spoken. Colloquial for as we put all the pieces together, the son of David. And so when Bartimaeus is crying, son of David, he's not simply referring to Jesus of Nazareth. This term, son of David, is clearly messianic. He recognizes Jesus. He identifies Jesus, no doubt about it, as the Messiah, the one promised to come from the line of David to rule as king forever. Son of David. His hope was not simply in Jesus of Nazareth. I say that again. His hope was not simply in Jesus of Nazareth. That's the Jesus most people identify in the world around us, Jesus of Nazareth. Good guy, taught good morals, gave a good sermon, and we need to be nice. That's Jesus of Nazareth. But that's not simply who Jesus is. Jesus is the son of David. He is the Messiah. That is a very different thing. And that's where we'll run amok with most of the culture and the other religions around us. That we believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the son of David, the promised one. This is faith. Believing that Jesus is who he claimed to be, who he was. Now, I'm sure he didn't understand all that this title entailed or would entail, but as much as he knew, he believed. This is the son of David. But that's not all he says. Excuse me. Jesus, son of David. Jesus, what does the word mean? The Lord is salvation. The Lord is salvation, son of David, Messiah. Okay, then what are his next words? Have mercy on me. Have mercy on me. Mercy, unmerited favor. I don't deserve what you can do, but I pray that you would do it in spite of myself. He's not giving some sort of a feel sorry for me speech. Jesus, son of David, can you see me here? I'm lying here and I'm begging and I can't see, and people are making fun of me, and he's not in the victim mode. In fact, he asks for mercy. In other words, he doesn't see himself as the victim. He sees himself as the perpetrator, whatever means that may be, but he needs the mercy of Jesus. mercy. The statement which comes from a needy and repentant heart. Now, whether he tied his blindness to his sin, I don't know. I'm not sure that he's been blind from birth. He talks about him seeing again. But he recognizes there is something he needs from Jesus that requires his mercy. It's actually a statement that's required for the healing, the spiritual healing from anyone. Lord, have mercy on me. It doesn't come with a proud, arrogant heart. It comes from a heart that recognizes its need. Mercy. Our only hope is in God's mercy. There's nothing he could do. He's hopelessly blind, and only Jesus can open his eyes. Reminds me of 2 Corinthians chapter 4. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 3 and 4. It says, if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled only to those who are perishing. Veiled, they cannot see. In their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. Everyone needs the miracle of the opening of their eyes so that they can see. They need the mercy of God. We're all blind, at least were at one point, requiring his mercy, his earnest plea. Thirdly, his dogged persistence. His dogged persistence, verse 48. Well, what happens as a result of him crying out to Jesus? And he's crying out. This is not, hey, is Jesus here? You think maybe you could get Jesus? Now, they would have heard this guy above. That's why they tell him to shut up. Son of David, have mercy on me! And he's screaming. Why? Because he's blind. He wants to see. It's urgent, and this is his one shot. What would you do for your one shot at sight? Well, don't bother him with your problems. We're going to make him king in Jerusalem. It's too busy for you little blind beggar on the side of the road. But that's the good news here. Jesus is never too busy for the blind beggars on the side of the road. No one is beneath his gaze, his ears. Jesus came, at least the first time, not to be made king, but to heal blind beggars. They're going to make him king, but he's got more pressing things like these guys to make them fit for the kingdom. But the more they tell to stop, the louder he yells. There is it's palatable, the desperation in this man. Jesus responds to people who are desperate. Right? Ask and you will receive. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. Now that's in the context of prayer, but it's an ascending intensity to each of those verbs. Ask, seek, knock. The Lord responds to desirous hearts who recognize their need and cry to Him, Lord, have mercy on me. And unfortunately, what I see so much in our contemporary culture and even in our churches is this lackadaisical attitude towards even the salvation. And in the aftermath of it, it's just sort of an add-on to life. Oh yeah, yeah, I got my hell out of get out of hell free card, and I guess get on with my life. But there's a desperation here. I ask you, have you ever understood this desperation for Jesus to heal you? Oh Lord, I cannot do this. I need you. And nobody stops him. The devil always tries to get in the way. Not, don't think about this anymore. Shut the guy up. But nothing gets in his way, for Jesus is his only hope. Luke chapter 18, 9. Jesus told a parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee, the other a tax collector. The Pharisee, standing by himself, prayed thus, God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I will give tithes. I give tithes of all that I get. But the tax collector, standing afar off, would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, now here's the same words. Be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted. Persistence. Jesus never rejects persistent cries for mercy. And it's a legitimate cry because he is our only hope. Fourthly, his distinct privilege in verses 49 and 50. His distinct privilege. Jesus says in John chapter 3, second half of verse 37, whoever comes to me, I will have a good conversation with to see if he's fit. Whoever comes to me, I will never cast out. I like the old King James. I will no wise cast out. No, nada. Good, no. You come to him with a sincere heart, realizing your own inadequacy, he will never reject that. Psalm 34, 6, this poor man cried and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all his troubles. And that is exactly what happened here. Verse 49, these are great words. And Jesus, what's the word? Stopped. And just pause there for a moment. He hears this guy screaming, and they're all telling him to shut up. And Jesus stopped. He stopped for Bartimaeus. And who's Bartimaeus? He stops for anybody who cries, Lord, have mercy on me. He stops. He stopped for you and he stopped for me. The son of David. I don't think if the King of England came to Vancouver and he saw me, and I would started screaming something, he'd stop. Laura, hey, Chuck, my taxes are too high. Oh, have mercy on me. Or the prime minister, or the premier, or the mayor. No, they'd haul me away. Too important to be bothered by me and what issues I may have in my life. Jesus stopped. He doesn't pass anyone crying out to him. He doesn't pass them by. Anyone who calls on him. And even if the whole world passes by, oh, that beggar again, Jesus will stop for those crying out for his mercy. What does Jesus say? Call him. Call him. How did you ever come to Christ? Because he called you. By name. Bartimaeus. Ron. Bob. Julie. Cynthia. Whoever you are. Call him. They call the blind man. Cheer up, he's calling for you. Good news. Jesus wants to see you. Get up. He's calling you. The word call, it's used three times in this verse. Call, call, call. The Greek word is phoneo, P-H-O-N-E-O. We get the word phone from it. It's right in there. You pick up the phone to call. He's phoning you. He's calling you. He's texting you. He's, I'm going to be really hip now, DMing you. Me? This is the Messiah. Yeah. Jesus does not ignore 911s. He answers his voicemail. He calls back. He responds. Don't you hate the people, you know, you send them and they never respond. He responds immediately. Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. But notice, Bartimaeus took the initiative when he knew Jesus was coming. So it's not just one-sided here. How does Bartimaeus respond? No, tell him to come to me. He sees, I don't know, he gets up. He takes his outer cloak, which was probably something he'd been laying on. This is what you put over you at bedtime and keep you worn like your jacket. Verse 50. And throwing off his cloak, he sprang up and came to Jesus. There's a deliberateness. There's an urgency. There's, as he was calling, so now he's moving. You could imagine how quick this was. Get out of the way. He probably hears where Jesus' voice is, and or somebody takes him there. And he's going to meet Jesus one-on-one to heal him. Isn't that a great story? And that's what he does for each one of us. He calls us to him, but we must come. We come quickly. We come immediately. If he hadn't come then, and he needed 20 minutes to think about this, what would have happened? Never pass that way again. That's why it's so important for people who are at that place of, I don't know, maybe you're watching online and you've never quite done this. You don't know there's ever going to be another opportunity. Jesus is here now. Now's your day. Today is the day of salvation. You put it off and eventually you just, Jesus is history. No hesitation to the invitation of Jesus. Who could pass up this opportunity? Lots of people. Lots of people. This is what's so sad. And all he needed to do was ask. His distinct privilege. Jesus calls him. Fifthly, his humble petition. His humble petition. Verse 51, Jesus said to him, Doesn't this strike you as kind of weird? Jesus knew all about this guy. And what does he ask? What do you want me to do for you? Well, duh. What do you want me to do for you? This guy's with his white cane. Now, why does Jesus ask that question? It's obvious. He wants him to name his need. He wants him to say it. Which is a key aspect even today of counseling. Somebody comes to see you and, you know, I need some help. You say, okay, the first thing what we need to do is we need to identify the problem. We need to name the problem. I can't help you if you don't tell me what you want. Go to the doctor. First question he asks you. What's ailing you? What's your problem? What can I do for you? And then, you know, if you got a problem with your back, you don't tell them, well, yeah, my toe's hurting. It's obvious, but, you know, for some of us, just being at the doctor is that step that I need help. Lots of people just won't even go to the doctor. What do you want me to do for you? Interestingly enough, it is the very same question, word for word, that Jesus asks of two of his disciples in verse 36. James and John, who want to be the greatest, they come to him. Actually, mommy comes to them, but anyway, he said to them, what do you want me to do for you? We want to be in the right hand and the left hand. One author puts it this way. Whereas the sons of thunder ask for extraordinary glory, Bartimaeus asks only for ordinary health. So it does depend on what you ask for as to whether you receive it. He is not simply a goody dispenser. What is your motive? He doesn't answer every prayer or every request, but only the requests that are in accordance with his will. Oh, Lord, I pray that you would give me a Mercedes Benz. No. Lord, I just need some transportation. Now we're talking. Rabbi, the man replies. Now, this term for rabbi is not the usual term for teacher. This term is actually Rabuni, R-A-B-O-U-N-N-I. It's a longer term, a term that is generally used only of God. He's only the Rabuni. Again, his faith in who Jesus is revealed. He's the teacher. He has a simple request that I may see again. Please just open my eyes. It's a request that we all must eventually come to him for. Lord, open my eyes. I want to see. I just don't see properly. It just isn't going. I just need clarity. Verse 52, finally, his restored perception. His restored perception. And Jesus said to him, go your way, your faith has made you well. His belief in who Jesus was had provided healing for him. Now, just so we understand that this is not just physical healing, his response indicates such. It is a perfect picture for a blind, needy world, not just physically, but spiritually. And only faith in Jesus can open the spiritual eyes. And I trust that we have all encountered the Jesus, the only one who can open our eyes, the Son of David, the Messiah, the Rabboni. And that we have experienced his opening of the eyes. 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter 2, 9. You are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. I was blind, the hymn writer writes, but now I see. Jesus has opened the eyes of the blind. Oh, and I've just referred to the fact that this man wasn't just interested in physical healing. The last part of verse 52, it says, immediately he recovered his sight. And what does he do? He follows him on the way. He doesn't go home, I can see now and make myself some money. Now he follows Jesus. This is the way it works. He opens the eyes to the repentant sinner crying for mercy, and now that sinner follows him on the way. After Jesus restores his sight and heals him, Bartimaeus is no longer sitting by the way. It's the same word, verse 46. They came to Jericho, and he was leaving Jericho, and his disciples, a great crowd, Bartimaeus, a blind beggar, the son of Timaeus, was sitting by the, now my translation says roadside, the word is hodos, it's way. He's sitting by the way. But now, he's following Jesus on the way. And that's what happens when you recover your sight. You're beside the way. Jesus opened your eyes, and now you are on the way. Sinners are beside the road, no purpose, they're blind, but Jesus puts you on the road, and we follow him now on the way. If you experience this merciful healing of Jesus, a beggar beside the way, now following on the way. For Jesus himself said, I am the way. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for the story of blind Bartimaeus, whose sight you restored. But we confess that the world is blind. We were blind. And only you can open the eyes for those who recognize their need. Their need of mercy. Sin has blinded us, and we need the Son of David, the Messiah, to restore that sight, that we are fit to follow you, that we have gone from beside the way in the ditch to on the way. On the way to Jerusalem with Jesus. And as you have said, that we too need to take up our cross and follow you on the way. And so that's where he's going and where we all need to go. But we thank you for your healing power, for your restorative ability, and the fact that you look upon any blind Bartimaeus begging beside the road. Thank you for that great gift of attention and salvation you give to anyone who cries out. For we pray it in Jesus' name. Amen. We want to conclude this morning again with a final song. Let's stand and sing, His mercy is more.